numbly pursued in the streets, a sense of control and order. The feeling reminded him of the many summer mornings he spent crawling across his schoolhouse floor, hammering in nails that had been squeezed up by the wood swelling. Alone and shuffling along on bare knees, trousers rolled up in thick, snug cuffs, he raised the hammer over the heads of old nails. Each blow echoed among the rafters like the report of a gun. It filled him with a small but warming sense of accomplishment, though every summer the same nails sprouted anew. Taru caught the attention of their server, who soon arrived with another bottle of tart plonk, cheap, acrid stuff that worked mercilessly on Senlin's stomach the following morning. They respected a truce while the wine was poured, but before Senlin could resume the subject of Taru's endless bon voyaging, Taru diverted their attention to the painter working on the sidewalk beside their table. Taru made a habit of heckling the middle-aged, hunchback artist. The artist, who hardly ever spoke, had paint in his hair and eyes that seemed always in motion. Other than painting, the only other activity he seemed to enjoy was smoking, which he often did, the sour yellow smoke rising straight as a flagpole in the breezeless atmosphere. Rows of his paintings leaned on the rail of the patio and around the spindly legs of his easel, but his work attracted little attention from passers-by. Taru enjoyed teasing the painter for his style, which was distinguished by thick daubs of unblended paint. The effect wasn't bad, taken from a distance, but on close inspection, his canvases reminded Senlin of a cutting board where a fish had been scaled.
"Painter, are you seeing spots? Have you suffered a blow to the head? Or perhaps you have only yet to connect your dots?"
Taru laughed, obviously trying to move Senlin toward a merrier topic. He continued, in a stage whisper to Senlin.
"Notice how the artist reeks of old woman's perfume. Who do you think funds all these splatters? Widows and spinsters. Homely as a dog's hinder, but rich as the tower. They model for him, I've heard, in the buff, and that's why he's half-blind, and all his brushes have cataracts."
Taru leaned over the partition rail, sloshing wine onto the walk.
"Look, painter, I have a talent too," he said, pointing at his spill.
The crooked painter patiently ignored Taru, though Senlin could tell he was affected. His already shortened neck seemed to shrink even further into his hump. Senlin felt a little scolded by the painter's persistence, his resoluteness. Taru, on the other hand, had gotten drunk and had raised his voice and had felt content, and there was no time for any of that. What was he doing with himself? A woman in a fur stole stopped to consider some of the artist's work. Taru gestured grandly at the paintings leaning nearest them.
"We're having a breakage sale. These, madam, are half off, and they come with a pot of paint so that you may repair them, if you like."
The woman crossed the fur at her neck and hurried away. Senlin raised his finger to intervene, but was interrupted by the painter whipping about. His large eyes were raw and red and dry with hate. Senlin half expected the painter to shoot Taru dead.
"You tease away my livelihood, Taru."
His voice sounded thin as a clay flute in comparison to Taru's theatrical baritone, but still it made Senlin recoil a little. Taru looked only more entertained, but before he could reply, Senlin clapped his hands to dispel the joke.
"Leave the man to his work. We haven't finished with our conversation."
"Did you just clap at me?"
Taru rubbed his face, blunting one point of his beard and turning the other in a crazed direction. When he opened his eyes again, they were unfocused. The drink seemed to be steering the ship now.
"No more conversations, headmaster. The world is rotten. Leave it there. Why be upset?"
"I am upset because we have pooled our human genius into the building of an elaborate tower and have filled it up with the same tyrants that have plagued our race since we crawled from the sea. Why does our innovation never extend to our conscience?"
"My conscience compels me to not throttle you or tackle the painter. That's progress.
That's not progress. It's fear of the law. And the law is corrupt. The innocent are still brutalized and murdered. I saw proof again of that today. The commissioner...
I do not endorse the man,
Taru said too loudly, and the painter's head swiveled around at him, his expression now one of incredulity, as if Taru were an idiot in addition to being a drunken wag. The look tempered Taru, and he continued in a more contained, though hardly more sober, tone.
He is a sneezy, wheezing little piggy. He is allergic to air. He sickens more easily than an infant. Every fortnight he hosts a buffoon's ball at his mansion, where he poses as a human and a patron of the arts. A human! A patron! Pshaw! He employs a harem of art appraisers who tell him what a painting is worth. He is a conny... a conny...
Taru spit to one side to clear his dry mouth.
A connoisseur of accounting. If we want to see his collection, we have to be invited. We have to dress like a virgin sheik. We have to look at the art through inch-thick panes of glass, because the vapours disturb his sinuses.
Taru thumbed his nose mockingly.
Here I was, concerned about murder. I had no idea the commissioner was also a bore, Senlin said acerbically, trying to sober himself now to compensate for his friend.
Taru only laughed.
Always so sour, headmaster. What can we do to cheer you up?
I need smaller tyrants, Taru. Give me a stingy baker or a mayor who nods off during the spring recital. It is time I went home. The school year starts in a few weeks, and I must prepare.
And Senlin neglected to say he was increasingly worried that home was where he would find Maria, long since returned by some easy means he'd failed to imagine. She was probably enduring all sorts of gossip and speculation. What had she told their neighbours? That her new husband had abandoned her? That she was perhaps a widow? What choice did he have but to go home? He was running out of money, and his ticket wouldn't be honoured forever. If only he could afford to fly, he could bypass the whole slog back down the tower.
I am going home,
Taru said, chin on his chest.
I'm serious.
So am I.
How long have you been here, Taru? 6 months? A year? You seem more a fixture than a visitor.
The large man's jaw worked, soared nearly, until the words hissed out.
16 years.
Years?
Senlin's voice cracked with surprise.
Why?
I don't have to explain.
The bottle seemed to chortle as he refilled his glass.
Suffice it to say, I lost track of time. And then, after a while, going home was impossible. What would I say to my wife? She took over the business years ago. The gold came out of the ground as easily under her watch as mine. We are not as essential as we'd like to think. She sends me a monthly allowance. As for years, I write her letters. I don't send. Pitiful, pitiful letters.
At the mention of the letters, he winced, as if suppressing a shudder. Senlin imagined what the letters must contain. A litany of promises. Taru sagged in his seat with a tragic sigh that rattled like a snore. It was late. They were drunk. The imported light of the moon swam like silver minnows on their skin, and the iron lattice of the tabletop. It was a slinking glow, fit for melancholy. He ached to think that he would have to remember it alone. He would never want to describe it to Maria. It would only recall their spoiled honeymoon. The chimes rang the 10 o'clock hour, wrenching open the lengthening silence between them. The artist began packing up his easel and paints.
I must gather my effects and buy a ticket,
Taru said firmly, though his voice was still thick with wine.
Meet me at the South Skyport in the morning, Senlin. I want a proper send-off. I will bring a bottle for you to dash on the stern. Or on my head. You are an all-weather friend. Good night.
Taru jarred the table standing up, upsetting the empty bottle, which Senlin narrowly caught with the tip of his boot. Taru blundered then against the rail, and this started him laughing. He passed around the gate onto the walk, and whether out of intention or inebriation, he staggered into the artist, knocking his sling of paintings and box of paints from his hands. The artist careened forward and fell, splayed out under a lamppost. Taru turned and bowed at the fallen man unsteadily.
Long dies the revolution. We have wasted our lives, painter, but I, at least, have not burdened the world with proof of it.
He began a leaning gallop away down the flagstone sidewalk and onto the cobbled street, his feet clapping flatly into the polka-dotted dark. His conscience pricked. Senlin rushed to the artist, now sitting in dismay, with his long fingers pressing the lines on his forehead into waves. Senlin apologized profusely for Taru, who was, he admitted, too often a bully to the poor painter. And while the painter stayed posed as a stone, Senlin began gathering the tubes and jars that spilled from the cornucopia of the painter's box. Mercifully, the wet canvas he'd been laboring over had landed face up. The paintings that had been on display were not so fortunately delivered. Many lay sprawled, glory side down, in the street. Senlin inspected each piece in the lamplight for signs of damage, continuing his string of apologies, while gently wiping scuffs of dirt from edges and blunted stretcher corners. His words quickly tapered, however, when he grasped the last of the toppled paintings. The painted scene was of a bench. Behind it, the reservoir scintillated with morning sun, and the conch-like silhouette of the fountain spiraled upward, jets of steam whistling out in white spokes. It was an evocative scene, if not an unusual style. But it was not the style or backdrop that struck him now. Sitting on the bench in the near foreground was a woman. Her form had been captured in just a few strokes, yet Senlin couldn't mistake her figure or the crimson-coloured helmet. The humiliated painter had finally risen and was brushing the street dust from his knees, when Senlin hooked his arm tightly, holding the canvas before him.
"Where did you paint this? When did you paint this? Where is this woman?" he asked desperately, and pointed to the captured image of Maria.
Chapter 5. There are endless currencies beyond the bills and coins in your pocket. Sometimes a ticket may be bought with a smile. A glass of wine may be payment enough for an entertaining tale. Every Man's Guide to the Tower of Babel. Senlin stood on the rooftop terrace of a two-story perfumery. It was the artist's apartment. An intense but muddled scent suffused everything. The rough stucco walls and the rounded stairs they had climbed, the tapestry draped over the entranceway, and the bouquets of paintbrushes blooming from terracotta pots. The air was so cloyed with perfume, it smelled almost like rot. Senlin would have found the air intolerable if he hadn't been so distracted by the elation and doubt that warred within him. What if it wasn't Maria in the painting? The style of the painting was so vague. Even if it was her, what if she had emerged only briefly from the anonymous crowd, only to disappear into it again, this time for good? And if she'd been so nearby, how had he missed her? Though he was filled with turmoil, he maintained his customary outward poise. The majority of the terrace was devoted to the painter's workspace. A sturdy four-posted easel dominated the floor. Stacks of canvases leaned against the parapet that encircled the roof, and, other than a modest cot and a frayed chaise longue draped in colourful fineries, the only furniture was a flimsy card table and two cane chairs.
"I don't understand why people pay for a second roof when we already have one over our heads. Custom, I suppose," the artist said, retrieving a stubbed-out cigarette from a full ashtray and lighting it. The painter had yet to respond to Senlin's initial outburst over the familiar figure in his painting. Senlin felt the artist was circling the subject, and it made him uneasy. The painter formally introduced himself as Philip Ogier.
He had a nervous habit of tucking his thin, jaw-length blonde hair behind his ears, which were round and prominent. His facial features were noble enough, his bright, darting eyes and active brow serving to offset his long, aquiline nose. The hump on his back seemed to swell a little more to the right, which made him appear always slightly crooked when he stood still or sat. His voice and expressions were almost feminine, but Senlin detected a powerful ego beneath his mild facade. Ogier invited Senlin to sit, and he did, though he stayed vigilantly on the edge of the seat, partly to keep his besotted mind from wandering.
"I know you are new to the baths, but I can't say I like the company you've chosen to keep," Ogier said.
"Taru is too often drunk and too much broken-hearted.
Drink and self-inflicted sorrows hardly excuse it."
Ogier smiled humorlessly. Senlin thought he understood Ogier's subtext. He was unlikely to be sympathetic or generous to a man who cavorted with his enemy. Senlin could only hope the artist was susceptible to bribery, though he had little enough to bribe him with. Ogier retrieved a bottle and two etched flutes from a blue-painted cabinet. Before taking his seat again, Ogier set a large skeleton key on the table just before him. It was a black, menacing thing, with a ringed grip large enough for two fingers to pass through. Senlin didn't recall there having been any locks on the doors they had come through.
"You seem to prefer wine, but would you take a little sherry? It's viciously dry, I'm afraid, but good,"
Ogier said. And Senlin, feeling he could not refuse, accepted the pour. Ogier toasted Senlin's health, and Senlin graciously returned the gesture, even as dread and wine made his stomach churn. This was exactly the situation Finn Gol had warned him against. Exposing his desperation to Ogier had made him vulnerable. He was entirely at the man's mercy. But since the day he'd lost sight of Maria, this was the first glimpse of her he'd had. The thought that she might still be, or at least had been, in the baths gave him hope enough to endure Ogier's agenda.
"How do you know this woman?"
Ogier asked, gesturing toward the painting that had gripped Senlin's attention. The painted board now leaned on the sturdy easel facing them.
"She's an acquaintance, if it is her. It's difficult to tell."
"An acquaintance?
If that's the extent of your connection, I hardly feel comfortable sharing her particulars," Ogier said, picking up and fidgeting with a substantial iron key.
"I misspoke. We are family, of course."
"Ah, yes. An absent-minded cousin, perhaps?"
Ogier lit a second cigarette, and then pointedly muddied the air between them. The addition of the smoke to the fragrant air made Senlin's eyes tear.
"You know, your initial reaction seemed genuine, and so I thought that you might really be in need of some assistance. But now you are so cool. I wonder if you aren't perhaps some vile opportunist, some deviant with a gross agenda."
Senlin's calm cracked a little. A pleading light weakened his gaze.
"She is my wife, though I have no proof of it. I promise that she will confirm it."
Ogier smiled at having coerced this revelation. His smugness made Senlin want to leap across the table at him. The urge surprised him.
"And she is lost?"
Ogier coaxed Senlin on with the draping smoke of his cigarette. Senlin could think of no advantage now to concocting a story for their separation. He had gone as far as looking could take him. He was nearly out of funds. He could go no further without some assistance. Ogier seemed reasonable enough. A trifle hurt by years of scorn from Taru, perhaps, and a little smug, and perhaps conniving, but he did not seem to be a criminal. Besides, what choice did he have? He decided to tell Ogier the entire truth, though it pained him. Senlin, dryly and succinctly, described their arrival on the train, the tumult of the market, his error in letting her go, and the moment of their unexpected parting. He summarized his search, leaving out, he scarcely knew why, Edith, their perplexing imprisonment, her torture, and his abandonment of her. He didn't wish to complicate the narrative of his devotion to Maria, and so he hurried on to describe his inefficient scouring of the baths. Having never been very good at emoting, Senlin worried that Ogier might mistake his reserve for indifference. He could only hope that the frankness of his confession would be enough to elicit some mercy from the artist.
"So, she's been lost for nearly 5 weeks?"
Ogier asked, and Senlin confirmed it. The artist sat considering the pots of orchids that enlivened the terrace wall, and even in meditation his eyes never ceased darting about. The artist seemed to weigh the merit of Senlin's tale. After a moment, he shrugged himself from his reverie and refilled their glasses.
"You wonder whether it's really her, the woman in the picture. It's so difficult to say, really, from a few strokes of paint,"
Ogier said, without a trace of sympathy.
"It is. And also, I imagine, you wonder if I know where she is now, or if she was just sitting there by chance one day while I worked."
"You have a wonderful imagination, Mr. Ogier."
Senlin could hardly keep the sourness from his voice. Though he risked everything if the painter took offence, he was embarrassed that his honest confession had been met with such austerity.
"I'm sure you're proud." "Pride is a funny thing."
Ogier drained his little flute and smirked.
"It's enjoyed most by those who deserve it least. Take our friend Taru. He is proud, but he has lost his purpose. Some time ago, there were those who loved him. There were those who thought him a great man. But now, well, you know how available his evenings are. He has many acquaintances, but few friends, Mr. Senlin."
"You certainly are more gregarious when he's not around to defend himself. Or do you want me to report your opinions to him?"
Though Senlin couldn't disagree with any of Ogier's assessment, he still felt it necessary to defend his troubled friend.
"To be frank, I played no part in that history. I have treated you only with respect."
Ogier retucked his hair, the tips of which were tinted blue and green by the transference of paint from his stained fingers.
"I only tell you this to warn you. If you're waiting for him to help you, he will ruin your patience, or worse, he will break your heart. I, on the other hand..."
He rose and walked, stiff as a man pacing out a map, to one of the many piles of canvases leaning against the parapet. He flipped through the boards until he found the one he was looking for. It was a small work, no larger than a schoolboy's slate. He returned to present it to Senlin.
"Let me turn up the lamp for you."
As he raised the light, Maria's face emerged from the gloom, captured in Ogier's strange but affecting pointillism. Her hair was loose, and she was not wearing her red pith helmet. She was posed with one shoulder forward, her head turned so that the slope of her nose seemed to echo the waves of her auburn hair. Behind her, ivory, tangerine, and canary orchids flowered, making the setting immediately recognizable as the same terrace he occupied now. Her expression was one Senlin had never seen before. It reminded him of the rapturous yet glazed expression of old icons. But of course, what Senlin absorbed most was that she was undressed to the waist. Senlin understood that violence was probably the expected response. He should be outraged to find his wife naked, her beauty exploited. But his emotions were too disorganized. He felt flashes of sorrow and shock, anger and desire. It was like two great horned rams were butting their heads violently together in the very center of him. Confronted so forcefully by this likeness of her, he could no longer console himself with reason. His prudishness could not repair the world. His search would not turn back time. His old, comfortable sense of himself and his wife and their life together was lost. His shoulders began to shake. He could not keep from weeping. When Senlin looked up, he found the artist reared back in embarrassment. Ogier seemed startled by this sudden collapse of composure. Strangely, the artist was pointing the heavy key at Senlin, though as Senlin regained himself, Ogier turned the key away.
"I'm sorry,"
Ogier said, his active eyes finally meeting Senlin's. They were luminous, intelligent eyes.
"I forget that not everyone is as ruthless as the tower." "All right. Let us discuss this as gentlemen. I'm laying down my arms."
He gingerly set the key again on the table.
Will you do the same?
I'm not armed, Senlin said, looking at the key in confusion.
What is that?
It's a very discreet and ingenious pistol.
Are you really not carrying any protection at all?
Why would I? Ogier shifted his hump against the back of his chair, crossing his arms with an expression of pleasant surprise.
You really are as naive as you seem. Spectacular! I can hardly hold you responsible for befriending Taru. I bet you would befriend a badger.
He indulged a brief, light laugh.
All right. I will tell you about your wife. But I doubt you will like it,
Ogier said, nodding at the nude of Maria, which Senlin still held slackly on the table. A month ago, Ogier had been painting by the shore of the reservoir, at a spot not far from his usual haunt, outside Café Riso. It was late morning when a woman in a red pith helmet came and sat down on the bench before him. Typically, Ogier did not include occasional pedestrians in his work, not unless they were in the distance and could be captured in a few strokes. But this woman had sat in the very centre of his view, had sat there as if transfixed. She hardly stirred, only stared over the artist's head for hours. So, Ogier had included her in his scene. Then, when the afternoon glare was beginning to diminish, Ogier packed his paints and collapsed his easel. As he was leaving, he interrupted her reverie briefly to thank her for being such a willing subject. And that, as far as Ogier was concerned, was to be the end of it. Only the woman began to follow him. He didn't notice until she caught him going up the stairs to his scent-soaked terrace apartment. She, seeming a little embarrassed but nevertheless brave, asked if he ever paid anyone to model for him. He said that he generally did not, with the occasional exception of the nude models he sometimes hired, most often a poor maid or au pair. The red-hatted woman went away, apparently upset, though Ogier assured Senlin he'd made no overtures of any kind. He hardly expected a tourist to be interested in posing for him, nude or otherwise. He put it out of his mind, in fact. Chalked it up to a momentary fancy by a tourist caught up in the exoticism of the baths. But she returned the next day, determined to model for him and to be paid for her work.
"I hope you take me at my word when I say that nothing inappropriate occurred."
Ogier emphasized the oath by laying his hand over his heart.
"She sat for me. I produced the painting you hold before you. I thanked her, I paid her, and she left. Again, I expected that would be the end of it."
The blue moonlight shimmered across the mirror balls far above, making them spangle like fishing lures. Ogier's cigarette flared its orange eye, and then was crushed into the darkness.
"But I did see her again, and every day for a week after. In that time, she told me many things. She spoke of tragedies and disappointments, and her plan to rescue herself, and she hoped her husband."
"I will give you everything I have," Senlin began, in the firmest voice he could muster.
"Thank you. But you don't have what I want,"
Ogier interrupted, his sympathetic simper hardening now.
"You have lost something that you love very much. I have also lost something that I love. So I have a very simple, very fair proposal. I wish I could say that we could be friends and assist each other out of the valour of friendship. But there are no friends in the tower. There are only partners in business. So, if you will help me recover what I have lost, I will help you."
"I'll agree to any terms," Senlin said quickly. "A painting of mine was taken. Stolen, I should say. I realize one painting might seem inconsequential. I have many, and I can always make more. But I am not a printing press. I am subject to fits of inspiration and ability. I can count on one hand the works that I'd consider to be my true successes. It was the greatest of these successes, my one true masterpiece that was stolen. I cannot remake it. I've spent years trying."
Ogier leaned forward, his eyes no longer darting about. He seemed to have finally arrived at his point.
"2 years ago, the commissioner fabricated an excuse to seize my masterpiece. Mr. Senlin? I want you to steal it back for me.
Chapter 6 Tourists who talk too often and too fondly of their homes can expect a lukewarm reception. Locals call such nostalgic tourists dirt-headed or mud-minded. One can hardly blame them. Home is an exaggeration made true by distance. Every man's guide to the Tower of Babel. Since the day he'd let her slip from his sight, this was the first genuine hope of finding Maria he'd had. The thought that she might still be, or at least had recently been, in the baths, gave Senlin hope enough to endure the perils that lay before him. He was prepared, if necessary, to knock the tower down for her. Senlin spent the night conspiring with the artist. He learned much about the commissioner, his palatial home, his opulent galas, his allergies and galleries. Whenever possible, Senlin tried to curve the subject back to Maria to learn more of her time with the painter, her current situation, her condition. But each time Senlin approached the subject, Auger locked his lips. Senlin pleaded with him to accept some other payment, going so far as to empty his boots on the table. But Auger was unmoved. He would accept only his masterwork. It was love in exchange for love. Nothing else would sway him. Senlin had no choice but to listen and to learn about the eccentric tyrant and the Bath societies, which included, in part, Taru's troubled history and the painter's own fallen star. The headmaster felt like a freshman studying for his exams. He was overstuffed with facts. Every new piece of information he learned only made the task seem more impossible. The commissioner's mansion was under heavy guard. Every hour of the day, there were two armed agents posted at each entrance and window. Many of the guards were armed with flintlock pistols, and the rest carried clubs or sabers. Worse yet, the house was also patrolled by a unique breed of dog that had a singular talent for ratting, for catching a scent and chasing it down. Auger's painting hung in the ballroom under an inch of glass. It was displayed near a balcony entrance, which seemed a stroke of luck until Senlin learned that the balcony was considered the keep of the mansion, and so was fortified with 2 30-pound demi-cannons and 6 men with long guns. As if that wasn't enough, there was also the Red Hand to worry about, who regularly prowled the grounds. He was rumoured to walk the mansion at will, or perhaps he slept at the foot of the commissioner's bed. Or perhaps he lived in the walls, or perhaps he merely appeared when his name was spoken too loudly.
"What a desperate mess!" Senlin moaned. "Precisely, and so it calls for a desperate man," Auger replied.
As the embers of morning appeared on the streets, Senlin left the painter with a promise he had no hope to keep. He would return with his masterpiece. Senlin walked the nearly deserted thoroughfares of the baths. The distant burble of the fountains sounded like the ocean caught in a shell. He felt a vague annoyance at the bath's nauseous impression of the seashore. It was a shore without a sea. It was a shallow, stupid place. But what of it? His mind was roving away from the matter at hand, turning to the comfort of criticism to distract himself from the looming reality. Even if he'd had the courage to run at the commissioner directly, it would take an army to make it past the door. No, it simply couldn't be done by force. Senlin tried to imagine himself sneaking through the mansion at night, a black scarf wrapped over his face like a common burglar, a gangly, graceless and loping burglar. Nope, stealth was out of the question, which left only deceit. The commissioner would have to be tricked into giving him the painting, or moving it out into the open where it was vulnerable, if such a place existed in the baths. The commissioner was a deeply suspicious and conservative man. Fooling him would not be easy. Senlin was not used to conniving. The music halls stood silent. The brasseries were empty. It was beyond late. It was early morning now. It occurred to him that a bath might focus and inspire him, but he quickly dismissed the idea as a cowardly indulgence. He must face the challenge. He must transform himself into a criminal mastermind. The thought made him laugh. If his students could see him now, stripped of all confidence and authority, a fish out of water, a sturgeon indeed. He wondered how all his old virtues had become failings, his calm, his patience, his love of deliberation, his rationalism and fair-mindedness, all were now flaws. He needed to be cocksure and shrewd. But even then, how could a cocky bookworm compete with a powerful commissioner? Senlin couldn't challenge him on any point, unless it be a contest of flaws. A contest of flaws. The thought made him laugh, and soon after made him plot. Morning vendors began to walk the streets behind carts heaped with fresh pastries and fruit. Then came the early bathers and the elders, who spoke incessantly about vitamins and their constitutions. A pair of plump children under the watchful eye of a governess broke the glass of the reservoir, splashing the flamingos awake. The coral-coloured birds began breakfasting on the abundant algae pooled about their stalks. A customs agent flirted with a young woman selling bathing salts and scented soaps from a tray hung about her neck. The clockwork hippo resumed its impressive gout. Senlin passed through it all so lost in thought that he hardly realized where he was going until he arrived. He stood before Taru, snoring under a towel in his usual lounge chair near the tidy shoreline. Senlin pulled the towel from Taru's face and slapped him with it until he awoke with a snort.
"Mug it, man! Let me be!"
Taru's grimace hardly softened when he realized it was Senlin who had disturbed him.
"I know, headmaster. I've missed my ship. Don't whip at me. My head is ringing."
"Get up. I'll buy you a coffee."
"I haven't even had my morning steam yet. Why are you pestering me so early?"
"Because there is much to do, my friend. Tonight, you are escorting me to a gala." Over coffee at Café Risso, Senlin explained his plan between Taru's bursts of ironic laughter. The giant, despite his hangover, was entertained by Senlin's audacious scheme. He thought it a lark, an articulate jest. Who would be mad enough to steal from the commissioner, from the man who held the leash of that psychotic dog, the Red Hand? Beside the absurdity of the proposal, Taru was mystified by Senlin's sudden desire to help the painter.
"What do you care about him? Let him fetch his own master scrawl. I wouldn't take two steps to pick it up off the street,"
Taru said, his head tracking the passage of a fresh-faced young woman in high-waisted shorts. When Taru turned back to Senlin, he found the headmaster was studying him closely.
"What?"
"A few facts came to light last night while I was owling with the painter. 16 years ago, you did not, as you say, lose track of time, Taru. You came to the tower with your wife, and you lost her." Senlin's words bleached the mirth from his friend's face. "You waited for her, certain she would find her way back to you, but she didn't." The young tourist with scissoring bare legs passed by again, apparently lost, but this time Taru did not inspect her. "You could have gone home. But what if she was not there? And what would you tell her father? Her mother?" "No, don't fidget and slouch down in your chair, Taru. I'm not chiding you. I am reminding you how it was that you became lodged here, became a lump that could neither move up nor down. You searched for her. You waited, sick with despair and humiliation. The flights of hope were no less painful. Your funds dwindled. Then, just when hope was all but eclipsed, a miracle occurred. A letter from your wife arrived at your hotel. Somehow, over the weeks after your separation, she'd beaten a path home. She feared you were lost or dead, but sent money anyway, just in case. And you—"
"Please, no more,"
Taru said pitifully. "You," Senlin pressed on, "took the money. You repaid some debts, dallied off the rest, but wrote nothing in response. Because what was the need? You'd go home and explain everything in the flesh. But shame kept you from going home. The next month, another letter and another sum arrived. She was tithing the universe.
seeding some of your fortune, just in case you were alive to enjoy it. And you had new debts to pay, and not quite enough left over to pay for a flight home. You spent weeks swinging between shame and indulgence, boasts and self-reproach. Gradually, you fell in with the local socialites. You became a staple of soirees. You could fill a room. Auger tells me that many, many parties were born on your toe and died at your heel. Still, you didn't write your wife because it was better for her to think you were dead.
"I will whip that painter with his own tongue,"
Taru said, but looked as if he were going to strangle Senlin, if for no other reason than he was nearest at hand. His dark grey eyes burned under his flushed forehead, and he fairly trembled with rage.
"He hasn't told you half the story. Don't pretend to stare through me."
Senlin shook his head with the stiff severity of a patriarch. "He showed me a portrait he painted of you in the days of your friendship. There was a little less grey in your beard then, but there was no mistaking it was you. He told me all about your falling out after you drunkenly confessed everything to him. After that, you couldn't bear his company."
"Oh, is that his story of our souring?"
Taru snorted and rapped his fist on the table.
"Let me tell you the other half, and we'll see who looks gallant then."
"I don't care. I'm not scolding you." Senlin grabbed his friend's hand. "We are the same man. I have recited my own story in telling yours. Listen, I have lost my wife in this terrible place. I have searched and floundered and proven myself a coward. I've gone half mad with hope and guilt. I've drunk myself stupid. I've hidden from my life. I am ruined, Taru. I can never go home, not alone." For the second time in recent hours, Senlin found himself recounting the saga of how he'd lost Maria. His tragedy revealed, he then shared what he'd learned from the painter, sparing no detail, despite the discomfort it caused him. It was so galling to think that she had been so close at hand. They may have passed each other a dozen times on the street, and only looked the wrong way each time. Auger had said Taru was unreliable, a false friend, and Senlin could only hope that his present abject honesty would be enough to prove him wrong. At the conclusion of Senlin's startling confession, Taru sighed and rounded his shoulders. His eyes glowed wetly as he gazed out at the evanescent traffic that passed under the churning mosaic of sunlight.
"I'm sorry about your wife, Tom. I'd not wish this demoralization on anyone. It's the most hollow feeling."
Senlin couldn't afford to let Taru slip into self-pity, though perhaps a better friend would have offered some consolation. It was too late now for pity. "I haven't much time. I may seem reckless, but I have a chance, a small chance, to find her. My wife is not safe at home, Taru. She is here somewhere, and lost. I have proof of it." Senlin heard the echo of Ogier's warning under the words that were rising now in his throat, felt the old dread return. Perhaps the painter was right to say that the tower made friendship impossible. But what other hope did he have? "Please, my friend, for my sake, for my wife's sake, help me steal this painting."
"You are running at the wrong end of the rabid dog, headmaster. Why risk your life when we could more easily confront the painter and compel him to talk?" Taru said. "He's stubborn, to be sure, but we could work the truth from him."
Taru raised and squeezed his fists. "Returning a painting that was wrongfully stolen is one thing. Torturing a man is quite another," Senlin said, and whether it was affected outrage or genuine conviction, Taru saw that Senlin was firm on this point. "I won't let the tower turn me into a tyrant."
"You have no idea what the tower will turn you into,"
Taru laughed and swatted the air, trying to dispel Senlin's sudden piety. When Senlin didn't flinch, Taru's laughter turned to an uncomfortable haw.
"Oh, it is too late. You are already insane. Do you have any idea what the Commissioner will do to a man caught stealing from him? You think your wife prefers a martyred husband to one that is gone but living?"
Taru searched Senlin's face for some healthy symptom of fear. Instead, he saw the headmaster craning forward resolutely.
"You mean to go through with it?"
"I do," Senlin said. Taru pulled a little silver flask from his white robe and bobbed it to his lips.
"Your plan is bad. You do know that. If your plan were a horse, it would have 3 legs, 2 heads, and no end to it."
He sucked his lips and screwed the stopper back on his flask. Senlin sat without argument, though Taru seemed to be waiting for one. The giant flinched first.
"Oh, all right," Taru said. "We'll roll your horse to town, headmaster. Your rickety, unlikely horse."
Taru stood abruptly and patted his pockets for his purse.
"I will need a new suit. Something peacockish and horrible."
From the outside, the Commissioner's mansion resembled a lavish hotel. A colonnade led from the public street to the house. Each column was striped with a broad black ribbon. The white marble facade of the mansion beyond was festooned with green garlands hung above windows that glowed with electric light. 2 files of immaculately presented customs agents stood by paneled doors that were as tall as the colonnade itself. Senlin studied these features while he waited for his fellow conspirator to arrive. He was freshly scrubbed and pressed and brushed. He seemed nearly dapper, thanks almost entirely to the top hat that Taru had loaned him and insisted he wear. And still he might as well be wearing a fishmonger smock for all the extravagance pouring past him. The fashion of the Commissioner's guests was so intense and diverse, it made Senlin wonder if he wasn't about to blunder into a masquerade. And there were hundreds of them. Men in white wigs or tri-cornered hats escorted women with spangling tiaras and hoop skirts, or exotic robes and jeweled turbans. He still wore his plain black waistcoat and narrow black trousers, which he had pruned of loose threads for the occasion. He looked more like a shadow than a guest. He could only hope that Taru's opulence would be sufficient for them both. And indeed it was. When Taru appeared, Senlin couldn't decide if he looked more like a king or a king's fool. His gold-embroidered pantaloons ballooned absurdly at his knees. His enormous hat looked like a cushion fit for a sheikh's throne, and his green felt shoes curled up at the toe. His beard and hair had been trimmed and waxed, and his skin still glowed from a recent soak. He bowed theatrically to Senlin.
"Behold, the suicide of fashion!" "No, no, excuse me. The fashion of suicide!"
Senlin managed a wan smile. "I must warn you, I am appalling at parties. I'm accustomed to hiding behind my wife's sparkling personality." He straightened his narrow black tie.
"You'll make a better impression on our host dressed as an undertaker. He's not like his guests, all high as fireworks and dim as smoke. He doesn't like sparkling personalities. No offense to your wife,"
Taru said, clapping his friend on either shoulder. He pulled Senlin nearer and whispered through a showman's smile.
"The Commissioner is as good-humoured as a guillotine."
"That is not comforting," Senlin said, cringing down against his sharp collar. A numb, floating sensation filled his stomach. His courage fled, and returned, and fled again.
"I feel a little ill."
"You must exhaust your wife," Taru said, and laughed.
Chapter 7 The politics of the tower are like garden politics, like neighbours bickering over the ownership of a plum tree. You may detect undercurrents of rivalry and feud, though none are very serious. Even so, it is best to have a supple opinion in matters of local governance. Every Man's Guide to the Tower of Babel. They joined the line of guests flowing through the doors, which were tall as oak trunks and stationed with butlers in white bibs and black tails. Senlin found their livery all too familiar. The vestibule seemed to stretch up about them like the walls of a gorge. Guests flung cloaks and overcoats at butlers, who were disappearing under the heaps. Brilliant electric chandeliers painted everyone with a halo, the light both beautiful and unnerving. He had read a little about electricity, had even seen a few crude models of generators which spat out sparks, short as an eyelash, but he'd never seen and hardly imagined electricity used in such abundance. The high walls of the great lobby were shingled with artwork. The gilded frames began at the wainscot and climbed to the ceiling. This salon arrangement was crowded, but showed the hand of a curator. Indeed, the hall seemed more like the wing of an overstuffed museum than the entrance of a residence. As museums went, it outshone the most fabulous he'd ever seen. Stationed intermittently along the wall, customs agents stood like lead soldiers, expressionless and severe, each holding the leash of a small, hairless dog. The crowd thinned here, as guests were careful to give the watchful dogs a wider berth. The breed most resembled a terrier in size and shape, though their naked pink skin piled and hung grotesquely at their jowls and haunches. The dogs, Ogier had explained the night before, were used to screen guests before they were allowed to enter the Commissioner's atmosphere. The Commissioner's allergies were legendary. He was so sensitive, a single boutonniere in a shared room was enough to send him into a fit of sneezing and wheezing. If the dogs detected any trace of perfume or tonic or pollen or any other pollutant, they would growl and nip at the offender, who would be unceremoniously frog-marched out the door and not invited to return. Such had been Ogier's fate. His skin and clothes were permanently suffused with scent from living over a perfumery. He wasn't allowed within 100 feet of the Commissioner. Senlin and Taru had carefully scrubbed themselves and their clothes in preparation for the evening, though Ogier had assured him being scentless did not guarantee safe passage. The Commissioner had been known to feign an allergic attack when annoyed by someone in his company. He would say that some whiff, imperceptible to even the dogs, tickled his nose. The Commissioner was quite proud of his sensitivity. It was this that first inspired Senlin's plot. The slow pace of the procession and the constant elbowing and shouldering that resulted drove Senlin to seek the refuge of observational study. He scanned the works of art they shuffled past, all of which was sealed under glass to keep the paint from off-gassing into the Commissioner's atmosphere. All styles and subjects were represented in the collection. Senlin recognized several of the artists from the rudimentary art lectures he gave his students. Beyond the hall, a wide stair curled up to an immense ballroom. The glare from the teardrop chandeliers made the pink marble columns and floors gleam like a carousel. Black silk banners, emblazoned with a gold astrolabe, hung on the walls. Senlin had never seen the flag before, and he didn't know what country it belonged to. A string quintet played an exuberant waltz, while couples bowed, spun, and fairly smashed together on a dance floor that was overrun on all sides by spectators. He'd never seen anything like it. This was not like the crowds that piled around the dozy shore in the morning. There was no chance of blending in here. Everywhere he looked, glances were being thrown, stares levelled, winks delivered. It was a great ogling madness. Through it all, butlers ferried silver trays of champagne flutes and hors d'oeuvres with the imperviousness of sleepwalkers. Bouts of high laughter challenged the music's dominance in the room. A yellow-haired woman climbed onto a grand piano, sitting unplayed under a white sheet near Senlin's corner of the room. She hiked up the thick membranes of her petticoats, showing her white bloomers in a display of such vulgar gaiety it made Senlin wince. His out-of-place expression made him stand out, and she locked her gaze on him, and with an expression between coy and aggressive, cupped her bust and pressed until her cleavage overflowed like a loaf in a bread pan. He tried to conceal his revulsion with a tight smile. The woman bit her thumb at him. Taru hissed at him to stop grimacing at everyone like a ghoul. He would have fled had it not been for Taru gripping his arm and forging a path onward, inward, deeper into the convulsing heart of the gala. Taru moved through the party as if it were his own. He slapped men on the back, rallied pouting couples with bawdy jokes, and pestered every passing servant for a drink. He was, it seemed to Senlin, born for bedlam. Senlin worried that Taru would forget the plan and fall entirely into the arms of his old society. But amid his flirtations, Taru continued to tug the headmaster through collapsing gaps in the crowd, moving them ever nearer their goal. As agreed, Taru escorted Senlin to the spot where Ogier's masterpiece hung, lonely, between the balcony doors. The enormous balcony seemed to attract young dandies and adventurous women. They flew in and out like swallows from a barn. But there was a small gap in the migration where the painting hung, and it was here that Taru finally deposited Senlin.
"I might be gone a little while. I have a lot of hands to wrench, and bygones to rehearse. I haven't shown my face at one of these comedies in months. Be patient. Take a drink. Take three."
And with that, Taru disappeared into the mass of skirts and coattails. He felt as if he'd found the party's fireplace, and the thought reminded him unexpectedly of Edith. He flinched at the memory. Behind him, dancers careened with unsteady elegance. He turned his attention to Ogier's painting. He stared into it as if it were a fire. The painting was, as he'd been told it would be, small, 14 inches tall and 8 inches wide. The thick gilded frame, which doubled the painting's size, almost enveloped it. The style was immediately recognizable as Ogier's. A young girl in braids and a white swimming dress faced the blue reservoir. The water stood just at her ankles. Other bathers stood farther out, but she seemed removed and alone. The girl was the subject and the center of it all. Her back was turned at the viewer. Even without seeing her face, Senlin could sense her hesitation. She seemed to be deciding whether to go farther out or stay near the shore. A bright white paper boat dangled loosely from one hand. Though the mirrored light was dazzling, the girl's dark shadow spread under her like a hole. She seemed to hover over deep water. It was odd and beautiful. He was startled from his reverie by Taru's broad hand on his shoulder. He turned to face a small, slight man in a closely tailored grey suit. The cuffs of his pants were set so high that his socks showed. A lock of sterling hair, delicate and stiff as a fishing hook, curled on his formidable forehead. His eyes were the colour of wet mortar, and his pale, wax-white skin made him look like a black-and-white print of a man.
"Mr. Senlin,"
the man began, in a high, sing-song voice.
"I hear I have you to thank for Taru's reappearance. You've done what a dozen invitations could not."
He stamped his boot and gave Senlin a little ironic bow.
"May I present His Eminence, the Commissioner Emmanuel Pound,"
Taru said, with a grander, more swelling bow, though it seemed to Senlin every bit as ironic as the Commissioner's. Senlin had been warned against trying to shake the hypersensitive Commissioner's hand, and so he bowed too, but as sincerely as he could. Coming up again, he said,
"You have a most fantastic collection, Commissioner. I congratulate you." "Yes, this Ogier is a favourite."
He pronounced Ogier's name differently than the artist, hardening the G and making the whole sound like it was being gagged upon.
"Appraised at 300 minas.
The amount was staggering. Senlin could have built a second and third schoolhouse for the amount.
"A bargain, I know. It'll double in value, I promise you, before I'm done with it."
The Commissioner tapped his lower lip as if it was a secret, and he was taking Senlin into his confidence. Senlin doubted that the Commissioner wanted any estimate of his fortune kept secret, but he tapped his own lip just the same. He wanted to win the man's confidence, so he would play the parrot.
"Taru tells me you are an art scholar,"
the Commissioner said, leaning backward, as if to study Senlin from a new angle.
"I have penned a few essays."
Senlin then went on to expound, peppering his speech with little proofs of his expertise. He knew enough to affect an accomplished art scholar, though really most of what hung on the walls was new to him. When the commissioner mentioned a particular artistic movement Senlin wasn't familiar with,